This podcast is sponsored by the Tree of Life Memorials and Digital in Stone. This is a new platform to create digital memorials, environmental legacies, and fine art monuments. This way we could share the stories, preserve the memories, conserve the land, and connect the souls, because love never dies.
This podcast does not provide medical nor legal advice. Please listen to the complete disclosure at the end of the recording.
Hello, and welcome to Everyone Dies, the podcast where we talk about serious illness, dying, death, and bereavement. I'm Marianne Matzo, a nurse practitioner, and I use my experience from working as a nurse for 45 years to help answer your questions about what happens at the end of life.
And I'm Charlie Navarette, an actor in New York City, and here to offer an every person viewpoint to our podcast. We are both here because we believe that the more you know in advance, the better prepared when a crisis hits to make difficult decisions.
So welcome to this week's show. Please relax, get yourself something cheering to drink and some pie. And thank you for spending the next hour with Charlie and me for a discussion about the health of Indigenous Americans and the health care they receive. Like the BBC, we see our show as offering entertainment, enlightenment, and education, and divide it into three halves to address each of these goals. Our main topic is in the second half, so feel free to fast forward to that no-gab section if you need to. Our topic this week is the view of the health of Indigenous populations, which is part of our ongoing series about health disparities. In the first half, Charlie talks about food, and we have the recipe of the week. In the second half, I'll be giving some historical context about the historical treatment of Indigenous Americans. And in the third half, we welcome back Dr. Gina Ford, a clinical nurse specialist from the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of New Mexico Health System in Albuquerque. And we'll be talking about the health care of Indigenous people during COVID. So, Charlie, what's new?
I'll say COVID is new, but no, everything old is new again. Yeah, that's about it. I got nothing to say. And I'm sticking to it.
You got plenty of nothing?
Well, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty
for me. Folks, do you see how easy it is to derail Charles?
I'm so easy, yes.
So easy.
Well, I'm not so easy.
It's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Mm-hmm. And then fry them up a little tartar sauce and yes. So what be happening out there?
Oh, you know, I hate to sound boring, but I'm really boring.
Honey, I've known you for decades. Yeah, boring is maybe below one on the list if you count down from 10. Boring. Though actually,
but actually,
you know, sometimes it is nice. And when someone asked me, so what did you do last night? What did you do over the weekend? Well, I read, I fell asleep reading, had a nap. Like, God, it's so boring. It's like, no, sometimes it's just the nicest thing to do, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Huh.
It is.
No.
We've been babysitting my daughter's puppy, who's a blue heeler, who initially when she was little was an awful lot easier than she is now because
wait, is that your daughter or the puppy?
Well, both.
A little bit of both. Yeah, right, okay.
But the puppy is almost a year now.
Yeah.
And so she's like in that like I don't even know how to describe it. Adolescence of full energy, full of piss and vinegar, gets into everything, like pulls up my solar lights outside and runs around with them in her mouth.
Aww.
I mean, just if there's a way for her to get into something, she just does it. But then she looks at you and it's like, oh God, I love this dog. So.
Yeah.
But she's a lot of fun. So we do the grand, and Dave and I say to each other, you know, if we love this dog so much, what'll happen if she's got a, has a baby?
Yeah. So, in our first half. When it comes to recipes that aim for authenticity in a historical context, many people believe that you should use only ingredients that were naturally found on the North American continent. But since we are far from purists, we found a great recipe for your next funeral lunch that includes non-Indigenous ingredients, but was found on a Native American history webpage. That's how you get around things. Which works for us. This week we offer.
Hey, the what? Internet what? Said it. The internet said it was authentic.
That's
so
right.
I
found it on the internet, so it must be true. And with that, so this week we offer pawpaw cookies. A pawpaw is a fruit native to North America, primarily found in the eastern part of the continent, ranging from Florida to southern Canada. It grows on the largest edible fruit tree in North America. Pawpaws were a staple in European settlers' diets and famously eaten on the Lewis and Clark expedition. The pawpaw has a green exterior with dark speckles. Inside, you'll find soft, creamy flesh. Let that sink in for a moment. That can be either whitish taupe or bright yellow, dotted with large dark seeds. The flavor of pawpaw is often described as a delightful blend of banana, kiwi, and mango. It has a slightly bitter aftertaste, but a pleasant zing upon the first bite. Ripe pawpaw.
Just like you, Charles.
Yeah.
You got that zing.
You've got that cool zing. It's not in there, but I like that song. Where was I? Oh, yeah, zinging upon the first bite. Ripe pawpaws are best enjoyed raw. Pawpaw seeds and skin need to be removed and not eaten because they are toxic to people when chewed. Pawpaw also goes by the name false banana. A little Viagra would probably help that. Poor man's banana. Pawpaw apple, custard banana, and Hoosier banana. If you can't find pawpaws in your backyard, like the ancient Seminoles and Choctaw Indians, you can substitute bananas in this recipe. Wait until the banana skins are speckled and nearly overripe. The speckling is natural sugar. So, please go to our webpage for this week's recipe for pawpaw cookies and additional resources for this program. Your tax-deductible donations are always welcome so that we can continue to offer you quality programming. Thank you in advance for making your donation at www.everyonedies.org. That's every, the number one, dies.org. Marianne?
Thanks, Charlie. The opening pages of the 1970 book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by D.D. Brown, Brown wrote, "The greatest concentration of recorded experience and observation came out of the 30-year span between 1860 and 1890, the period covered by this book. It was an incredible era of violence, greed, audacity, sentimentality, undirected exuberance, and an almost reverential attitude toward the ideal of personal freedom for those who already had it. During that time, the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed. The historical treatment of Indigenous Americans is a sorrowful one. And perhaps because of that, it's a dirty little secret that's not taught in schools or part of our national conversation. I grew up with an older brother who liked to watch Western movies on Saturday afternoon, and honestly, the only history I knew of American Indians was what I saw on Saturday afternoon, which included violence, scalping, and the burning of the settlers' ranches. I didn't know any better, and my Catholic education never contradicted that view. It wasn't until I was in my late 40s and recruited by the University of Oklahoma that I began to learn a different story. I conducted research with the people of the Comanche tribes and heard their stories firsthand and honestly was ashamed to be so old and not have known the extent of their mistreatment. So today, we're talking about historical trauma and healthcare disparities that negatively affect the health of Indigenous Americans. Dee Brown, in his 1970 book, Bury My Heart in Wounded Knee, talks about the chiefs and warriors of the Dakota, Ute, Sioux, Cheyenne, and other tribes, the battles, massacres, and broken treaties that systematically stripped them of freedom. Some of the tribes believe that to survive, it would be necessary to cooperate with the government and adapt to European ways. Those chiefs sealed the fate of their tribes in 1875 when they signed a treaty relinquishing their land east of the Mississippi in return for promises of wealth and better land. The U.S. government used the treaty to justify the eviction of the Cherokee Nation in an exodus that the Cherokee will forever remember as a trail where they cried. Those who have researched historical trauma of Indigenous people place the origin of the systemic racism and cultural genocide of the Indian boarding schools in the U.S. and Canada. From 1819 to 1969, the U.S. government set up and supported more than 400 boarding schools designed to extinguish Indigenous culture and assimilate young Native Americans into white society. About half the schools were run for the government by or supported by churches of various denominations. The goal, in the words of one of the first school's founder, was to kill the Indian in him and save the man. These schools forcibly removed Indian children as young as four from their families and placed them in residential schools where their hair was cut, their native clothing removed and replaced with the school uniform. Their names were changed, they were not allowed to see their parents and family, and they were punished for speaking their native language. I have a few links in the show notes with films of interviews with what are now older Native Americans talking about being in the school. And one of them talks about how when he spoke his native language, the priest had him bite onto a rubber band and had him pull it out as far as he could and let it go so that rubber band slapped into his lips and hurt him to help remind him not to speak his native language. When the families of these children refused to follow the law and send their children away, the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the U.S. government received congressional authorization to withhold food rations and supplies from American Indian families. In this way, they weaponized food to force obedience. Now, the children didn't know that their parents had no choice in sending them away, nor did they know that the family faced starvation if they didn't comply in enrolling and keeping their children in boarding schools. A Senate report from 1969 acknowledged that the boarding school system was used as a weapon to break the children's bonds with their families and culture, force assimilation, and to take the Indigenous people's land. 100,000 children were legally removed from their family, and 40,000 of them never returned back home and have thought to have died. The causes of death that were reported during that time were infectious diseases, accidents, and wounds, with tuberculosis as the single largest killer. But not all the deceased children were buried in the cemetery. The schools were known for their emotional, physical, and sexual abuse of the students, who endured militarized discipline, institutionalized malnutrition, systemic overcrowding, unsanitary conditions, poor medical care, and forced labor unsupported by a balanced or sufficient diet. When children died from their abuse, it was thought that they were buried in unmarked graves across the country. In 2021, Kawasas First Nation in Saskatchewan found 751 unmarked graves at the site of a former Indian residential school. Just 1 month before, There were 200 unmarked graves that were found in another school in British Columbia. Of the 400 Indian schools in the USA, the first boarding school to break ground in a search for human remains was Red Cloud, a former Jesuit Catholic Indian boarding school. But that wasn't until 2022. Now, Canada has paid millions of dollars to former boarding school students and relatives and has set up a commission that described the system as cultural genocide. At least 150,000 Indigenous children were impacted across the country. In July 2022, Pope Francis traveled to Canada for a week-long penance tour and issued a historic apology for the church's role in the country's catastrophic policy of Indigenous residential schools and begged forgiveness. He said, "I ask for forgiveness, in particular, for the ways in which many members of the church and of religious communities cooperated, not least through their indifference in projects of cultural destruction and forced assimilation promoted by the government of that time, which culminated in the system of residential schools. In the face of this deplorable evil, the church kneels before God and implores his forgiveness for the sins of her children." He went on to say, "I humbly beg forgiveness for the evil committed by so many Christians against the indigenous people," said the Pope. Now, in another one of those films that I watched, there was a girl who said she was 4 years old when she was removed from her family and brought to one of the Indian boarding schools in the U.S. And she said, you know, they were given a school uniform, which was a dress. And she said that the priest would have her come and sit on his lap and that he would touch her under her skirt. And she said, and she was a very old woman now, and she said, "I never understood what I had ever done to him to have him treat me like that." Those children who did survive were wounded by violence, neglect, sexual abuse, and seeing their classmates buried or else never knew where they had disappeared to. The spiritual violation and disrespect they experienced affected for them how they saw themselves for the rest of their lives. Many turned to alcohol to tame their feelings or internalize their trauma that was then exhibited in self-harm, suicide, substance abuse, and mental illness. Now, as I was writing this and researching this, I thought to myself, there's really a difference between how the Indigenous Americans were treated and how other, not that the Indigenous Americans were immigrants, but how immigrants who came to the country were treated. You know, each group that came, you know, when the Irish came, they were treated extremely poorly and were given the worst jobs and had little money and no support. And the same when, you know, big groups of Italians came, they had the same experience. But they didn't take the children of the Irish or the Italian and put them into special schools and try to take the Italian or try to take the Irish out of them and try to, incorporate them into what was called, you know, the American life. And I thought, well, why was it different? Why didn't they do that if they did that to the Native Americans? And then I came to the conclusion, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, that it was because really why they did that was because they wanted the native land. You know, the Irish didn't come with anything that the U.S. wanted. You know, and the Italians didn't come with anything that the U.S., you know, government wanted. But the Native Americans had the land, and that was what they wanted. And I think what they used is these Indian schools to break the children and break the family and be able to get the land. From this cultural genocide and abuse came generational poverty, destructive government policies, and patterns of health disparities and increased disease burden. Indigenous Americans have higher rates of cancer, dementia, and diabetes compared to other U.S. populations. Specifically, a 2022 CDC report found Black Americans American Indian, Alaska Natives, and Hispanic people were 80%, 30%, and 20%. So Americans, Black Americans, 80%, Natives, 30, and Hispanic, 20, more likely to be hospitalized for food, respectively, than white Americans over the past 13 flu seasons. Data showed people from ethnic and minority groups also experienced more severe flu outcomes, but they were less likely to receive flu vaccines compared with white adults due to their distrust of the medical system, misperceptions about vaccine safety, and higher level of concerns about side effects. The high disease rates within the Native American population are those higher rates for cancer, dementia, and diabetes compared to the U.S. populations. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, American Indian and Alaska people have higher rates of cancer and lower survival rates compared to non-Hispanic white populations in the U.S. Native American men have higher rates of liver, kidney, colorectal, stomach, and lung cancer, as well as myeloma. And we have Luna with us today, so if you hear yipping, that's her. Compared to white women, Native American women have higher rates of liver, stomach, colorectal, cervical, and kidney or renal cancer. Dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, continues to rise in Indian country. Studies indicate that Native Americans have one of the highest rates of dementia in the United States. A 2019 study published in the Daily Evergreen found that Native Americans have a 35% lifetime risk of developing dementia. The American Diabetes Association found that Native Americans have the highest diabetes rate of all ethnic groups in the United States, as well as a higher incidence of long-term complications from diabetes. According to the National Indian Council on Aging, diabetes prevalence is 60% in some tribal communities. So these data give us an indication of the illness within the population, the origin of mistrust and fracturing of the families go back to those Native American schools. And I don't know if we're going to get to a point where Canada did, where there are reparations available, but it certainly would seem that that's something that should occur. Charlie, what are your thoughts?
I want to change the channel. I know this, but it's still heartbreaking every time I hear it. And as you were talking, you know, again about, you know, taking the land away, I was thinking of the film version of Killers of the Flower Moon. It was just about greed. That was it. And then just the, you know, as the book and the movie shows, just the systematic murders of Native Americans. Just, you know, they were pushed off, you know, their land where they had lived for hundreds of years into, you know, crummy, you know, places, and then some of them struck it rich in those crummy places because there was oil on their land. And, you know, what did the white folks do? Come in and just start killing them off for the land.
Well, the families who owned that land, at least from my reading of the book, white men would come and marry these Indian women.
Yeah.
In an effort to get that land, get that money, and then, in fact, would then say, "Oh, this my wife is not capable of making these decisions."
Exactly.
You know, I'm the man. Yeah. I will make these decisions. I'm the man. I'm the white man. I will make these decisions. And it was really just such a
I know.
Abuse.
Yeah. Did you guys see the film?
No, I read the book, yeah. But I haven't seen the film yet.
Yeah.
I've been watching films about concussions.
Oh, dear. In our third half, today we are joined by Dr. Gina Ford, a clinical nurse specialist from the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of New Mexico Health System in Albuquerque. Dr. Ford is indigenous herself, coming from the Southern Cheyenne and citizen Potawatomi nations, and practices palliative care in New Mexico, caring for many tribal patients from various reservations and pueblos.
You know, Charlie, when I did this interview with Gina, and really want to thank her for taking the time to talk with us, this part focuses on the period when COVID struck and the effect on the indigenous populations. And you can just hear the heartbreak in her voice as she talks about what happened and the care and the decisions that were made for people, for the indigenous populations. So,
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Decisions made for people during COVID? Or are you talking about in the past?
Yes. No, for indigenous people during COVID.
Wait, I don't understand. Who would be making decisions for these folks? What?
Well, I don't, Charlie. I think you need to listen to what she has to say. It is very surprising.
It's the 21st century. All right.
Well, you know. So here's the thing, Charlie. Yeah. It is the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about what I was talking about in the second half, there's this, the people that were in those schools are older adults today. I mean, those schools were open until the late 60s. You and I, if we were in an indigenous population, we could have been in those Indian schools. We're old enough, I guess, that could have been us. And so these people who grew up in those schools, then, you know, now they're older, they got COVID, and they're in a position to be treated differently than the majority whites. And so I think it's just really worthwhile to listen to Gina's story.
Wasn't it true that the Indigenous Americans had a higher burden of COVID illness and COVID death? And what was your experience in terms of people coming in with COVID into the hospital?
Mm-hmm. It was terrible. You know, I think that working in healthcare, you know, I was the lead for our palliative group at the time, the inpatient group. And so we all were kind of bracing ourselves for, you know, what was coming, but I don't think any of us had any idea on what to expect. And the hospital I was working at, we were the hub for all of the reservation pueblos at the time. You know, what we were hearing on the news and social media was, oh, this is just going to hit the immunocompromised, the old. And that's not what we were seeing. You know, it was obliterating families. And, you know, I was in their charts. I was seeing them. And these were young people, you know, people in their 20s, their 30s. And we had families, you know, room to room. You know, we had a mother, daughter, a father. We had grandparents, but we had the young and the old. And it was wiping out tribes. And it wasn't just here, you know, at home. I know my tribe was being hit hard, and you know, it was really, really frightening. It was terrifying to see all of this, and it was very traumatic seeing this not only for myself, but for my team and, you know, caring for these families and then, you know, calling them. It was really frustrating too for all of us, you know. Unfortunately, none of us are still working together or at that place. And only a few of us, myself, are still working in palliative care. We all collectively have PTSD from what we experienced. But, you know, palliative care is hard enough as it is. And then you experience that. And then trying to call families, you know, sometimes English is their second language and explain to them, you know, and we've been talking about all of these historical traumas and explain to them, you know, what happened. So what would go on is somebody would be sick and they would go into their local IHS clinic or hospital, you know, whether it's in Arizona or Gallup here in New Mexico, and they would be triaged to the nearest hospital. And depending on availability, so that could be here, that could be Phoenix. So families, you know, would take somebody in and one person might be medi-flighted to Flagstaff, to Phoenix, another person would be here. And nobody knew. Families were split up. And so we would be calling them, trying to explain to them over the phone. And the way a lot of tribes are in these reservations that are in really remote rural areas is there's no internet access, you know, so you can't use, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, I you know how I am with my temper sometimes, my eyes are already twitching thinking about this, you know, I got a call and they're like, we bought iPads, you know, here you go. Now you can FaceTime. And I like totally lost my cool. And I was like, who the hell are you gonna FaceTime? I was like, you don't even know your population that you're caring for. And they were like, well, they can leave the reservation. And I'm like, it's on lockdown. I mean, so it was just, it blew my mind that these administrators had no idea our population. And so if you can think about it, we were calling people trying to explain that their loved one was in the hospital on a ventilator and may not make it out. And it was really distressing. And at one point we called, you know, myself and our social worker called and we talked to an 18-year-old girl who was a senior in high school and her parents, one was in Albuquerque, one was in Phoenix, and her grandparents likewise. And she was taking care of her six siblings and she immediately became the decision maker for everyone. I mean, this was reality. And then we called somebody else and, you know, she was a mother who had symptoms and, you know, her husband and her parents, you know, were all gone, but she wasn't going in because she was like, look, I go in, I don't see family anymore. She goes, you know, they're being sent to different places. And then at that time, you know, people were being cremated. And, you know, because there wasn't, you know, the funeral homes were full. And that's a big violation for some tribes. And she goes, I'm getting these ashes back. I don't know who these people are. I don't know if this is my loved one. And then to add insult to injury in the ICU, you know, that I had done my, you know, doctoral project in that previously, you know, I you know how it is working. You spent hours and hours in there, you know, working. Group, the intensivists that I previously would have, you know, let care for myself, my family, you know, was making every Indigenous person that came in a DNR, do not resuscitate, and against family wishes. And so we were getting calls from family going, hey, this is not what we wanted. This is not what we signed up for. And so this was a huge, huge ethical dilemma, not only for myself, but for my team and, you know, going and advocating for them and, you know, taking it up the chain, you know, our hierarchy and not getting any support. I mean, this is just something that we're still processing to this day. And I mean, this across the board. And, you know, I guarantee you, if you were a white affluent person from Santa Fe coming in, that did not happen to you because we saw that it did not happen. And so, you know, I think, and, you know, I don't know for sure, but I think maybe a few years down the road, I'm going to add this to my talk of recent historical trauma because so much happened during COVID. You know, we've lost so many people, so many families. And, you know, that's why even today, you know, my son plays basketball and, you know, a lot of people from the reservation will come in and they're all vaccinated, triple vaccinated, but they're still wearing masks. And it's, I think, because of the trauma they endure. They've lost so many family members. And so I think that And there's a lot of trauma from that. And it's terrible. It's terrible, some of the things that we saw. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm not the only one. And, you know, the sad thing is, and I thought about this more than I care to talk about, more sleepless nights, but I don't think any Indigenous person would be shocked to hear that happened, you know, that they were automatically made a DNR. They'd probably be like, yeah, that happens, you know, and that's what's so heartbreaking to me. And, you know, this is just stuff that I've seen professionally. You know, I could tell you personal stories of things that happened to my family or my friends, you know, but I don't think that anybody would be shocked about that. And that's why I think that this is so important to me now that I feel like I have a platform, you know, and the education to back it up, that I use this to provide the knowledge, because there is such a knowledge deficit about it. And to talk about this and say, hey, this has to stop. We have to make these changes. It's so important.
And I think too, that we as a society have not even really processed what happened during COVID. You see people, you know, all up in arms because masks were recommended. And, you know, then there's like, well, did it really matter? And the different interventions that were put forward. But my daughter's a nurse and just graduated nursing school when COVID had hit. So her first job was doing, you know, the job that you're talking about. And I have to think that she's still traumatized. And, you know, we say, well, you know, telling people by iPad, you know, goodbye to a loved one. Well, you know, for the white population who had internet, it was still really traumatic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And for the Indigenous Americans, I know from experience that on the palliative care unit, when we had somebody from the Indigenous population die, there was not room in the room for all the people who would be there. And, yes. You know, because everybody would come. And I can't imagine the trauma of saying, no, you can't go in with them. You can't be there with them. You know, the trauma for, you know, the mainstream population was, I had surgery during that, Gina, and I got dropped off at the door. Mm-hmm. And it, as a healthcare professional my whole life, it was like, this is horrible. And I thought to myself, what do people who, you know, are not kind of used to the hospital and not used to how to advocate for themselves, how do they walk in these doors for, you know, like for me, it was like a 5-hour surgery. How do they walk in those doors and then be alone that entire time, you know, in pain and have nobody there? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I can't imagine. I mean, I know how it was for me, and I know the stories from my daughter, but culturally, that whole experience goes against everything that, you know, was sort of dear to the Indigenous population, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's, again, you know, making generalizations, you know, I can speak to my tribe and some of the Pueblos and tribes out here, but there are very beliefs that, you know, must be done during that time. I, you know, I've shared with you, like with my mother when she died, you know, we don't leave the body. We have to stay with our loved one, you know. And so, like when my mom died, you know, Dr. Salinas knew that. He stayed with her till my family could get there. You know, that's just something we believe. And so I, you know, if you think about that in the terms of COVID, you can't even be there. Some of the Pueblos out here, one of the tribes out here, you have to be buried on the day of death before sunset on tribal lands, you know? Mm-hmm. And so pre-COVID, we would do everything in our power to make that happen. One time we literally helped put the body in the back of a pickup truck so they could, you know, haul butt to their land to get it done, because that's what you do. You honor their beliefs. I mean, who are we to question that? That's what they want. We'll get it done, you know? And so many, many tribes don't cremate. It's a violation of, you know, their beliefs. You know, my tribe doesn't believe that, but other tribes do. And so, you know, here, you know, we had the semi trucks, you know, where we were putting bodies in there, and then some funeral homes were backed up. So they were cremating them in the beginning, you know, the first wave, and then sending these ashes out there, another violation. You know, again, this didn't happen all the way through, but, you know, there was just insult after insult after insult. You know, some tribes believe in painting. You know, you have to, you know, my tribe's one of those. We paint the body in specific ways before death, and that couldn't be done. You know, there's the blessings. There's just, you can go on and on. And again, you know, this isn't just for Indigenous people. I'm sure many, many, many cultures have their own. But it was, there was like horrible insults and atrocities that were done. And I think I'd like to say everybody at the time in healthcare was doing the best that they could under the circumstances. But it was just, it was a terrible time. It was a terrible, terrible time.
And I think that, like I said, we as a society, and maybe, you know, you know, you and I as palliative care experts really need to be, you know, talking and writing about that, because it's really not, not yet been healed or discussed, and you can't heal without talking about it.
Right. Exactly. And I think I, you know, I know personally that I had so much anger and trauma from what I saw during COVID. And I felt like we were just, you know, just coming out of it. And then, you know, losing my mom in that way. And then that's kind of when I took that time off. And I felt like I was still kind of, you know, trying to make my way through that. And, you know, I'm working again. I've been working, you know, for about a year and a half. I'm back in palliative care at a different institution. But nobody, you know, and I worked really hard at the last place to build a team. And they were great, great clinicians, great advanced practice nurses, social workers, and none of them are there. You know, everybody left after that. And it just breaks my heart to think about that. And I'm still in contact with all of them, but it's just, you know, we have a shared trauma from what we saw. And,
well, there's been an exodus from nursing itself, you know. Like my daughter says to me, she says, "Mom, I was traumatized." And, you know, we think, well, you know, for people who weren't there, how bad could it be?
Yeah.
But she wrote to me, she wrote this beautiful long note about just one day. And it's heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking to see what, you know, and I think, well, what a new nurse, you know, and a young woman.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Like when I was that age and I had my first job, I had one death the first year I was a nurse. She never had only one death a night, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's hard to even get your head around.
And I think that's why it's so triggering now to hear people say, "Oh, it's not real," or the vaccine, you know, I just can't, I just have to remove myself from that. And, you know, my husband has a really good analogy to save me from people, unfortunately, you know, that are too close to us that I can't completely walk away from, that say things like that. And he's like, you know, think about people that experienced war, whether Vietnam, Gulf War, whatever. He was like, you know, and they come back, would you tell them, you know, "Oh, that wasn't real. You, what you saw wasn't real, what you experienced"? No, because you weren't there. You didn't do that. You would never dream. So just don't talk about it like that. You know, don't be that disrespectful, insulting. And so it's true. And, you know, I have to remind myself that I saw a very unique situation, and a lot of people didn't experience that, but it's still, it was traumatizing. And so that's why I think at some point I'll be adding that, unfortunately, to my talks and to my writings, is another, you know, historical trauma for our Indigenous people because of how, you know, it impacted them.
And I think that's an important, probably next piece of our professional careers, is to talk about that. Because we started, actually, Everyone Dies, we're in the process of starting it when COVID hit, and it just so happened that our first podcast was like April of that, of the beginning of COVID. And somebody wrote, messaged me on Facebook or something and said, how tone deaf can you be to be talking about death now? And I wrote back to her and I said, this is really the time to be talking about death because people are dying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a sense to not to normalize the COVID experience, but to normalize that people die. Mm-hmm. And that although you're not planning on a pandemic, you still have to be prepared and still have an understanding of serious illness and how to get through the grief experience and all of that. I mean, when are you going to talk about grief except, isn't that a great
time? Well, I mean, who is planning on a pandemic? Who is planning outside of palliative care and hospice, maybe even healthcare, who plans on death? Who plans on that? Nobody does unless you're sick. And so I think it's really important to talk about it and to plan. You need to normalize some of this because, hey, none of us are getting out of here alive. You know, we need to talk about this.
Right.
Wow. I don't know that. I mean,
you think, oh, it's, you know, 20 whatever, 24.
Yeah. It's like
this stuff can't still be happening. Well, brother, it is.
And on that cheery note, please stay tuned for the continuing saga of Everyone Dies, and thank you for listening. This is Charlie Navarette, and from Marcus Zusak, author of The Book Thief, it kills me sometimes how people die.
And I'm Marian Matso, and we'll see you next week. Remember, every day is a gift.
This podcast does not provide medical advice. All discussion on this podcast, such as treatments, dosages, outcomes, charts, patient profiles, advice, messages, and any other discussion are for informational purposes only and are not a substitute for professional medical advice or treatment. Always seek the advice of your primary care practitioner or other qualified health providers with any questions that you may have regarding your health. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard from this podcast. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Everyone Dies does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, practitioners, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned in this podcast. Reliance on any information provided in this podcast by persons appearing on this podcast at the invitation of Everyone Dies or by other members is solely at your own risk.